Welcome to A Gram of Hope. I'm your host, Jerome Graham. You know, today we're going to be talking about something that is major. I don't care what type of season it is. I don't care where you live at. This thing here has existed all the way back to the days of watching Mickey Rooney on a program where he was an orphan. Or how about Oliver Twist, where there were orphans? Well, foster programming is so necessary. Many of us remember that song, "It's a Hard Knock Life for Us." And for many of today's children, I gotta tell you, man, it's still a hard knock life. Fortunately, we have somebody that can help navigate through all of the twists and turns of understanding how to start maybe a foster home, or why it's so necessary to have a foster home. We're speaking to Ms. Sherry Dunn. And Sherry, well, she's the recruitment supervisor for Lucas County Children's Services. How are you, Sherry?
I'm doing good today.
All right. Well, it's good to have you on A Gram of Hope today. And we just want to give people hope and let them know that no matter what you're going through, and I got to give a personal story, there is hope because there are resources, and you've got many of those resources at your hand. My personal story is I had some nieces and nephews that, because of some decisions that my sister made early in life, they had to get placed into the foster care system. Hats off to the system, because they were able to keep all of them together as a unit, and they took reasonable care of them. Is it perfect? Well, there's nothing perfect in the world, but if you can keep a family together, there's hope. So let's talk about this hard knock life situation. Talk about what you do and how you help to keep folks like my family together and other families together as best as you can.
You got me with that song stuck in my head now. And I'm thinking the version that you're thinking of is a little different than the version that I'm thinking of. But nonetheless, well, I am the foster care and adoption recruitment supervisor for Lucas County Children's Services. So my job is finding foster homes and adoptive homes for kids that come into care from Lucas County. And it can be very tough, and it has been tough of lately. I think COVID kind of knocked us for a loop, and then we just haven't been able to get back up since then. So currently, right now, we have, I want to say, almost 195 foster homes and over 1,000 kids in care right now. So we are definitely looking for people to open up their homes and their hearts to foster kids from Lucas County.
195 homes.
Yes.
And over 1,000 children.
Yes.
Wow. Do any of those children, do any, and I'm asking this from my perspective, because I'm curious, are there children, if there's 1,000 out there, has anyone ever asked how many more that people don't know about that may be out there? Because Lucas County is like one of those intermodal, well, it's in the city of Toledo, of course, and that's one of those intermodal type of cities where people come in from close states, and a lot goes out from this city into the state of Michigan, the state of Indiana, the state of Pennsylvania. There's a lot of transient movement. Do you guys ever get surprised by somebody coming in and saying, I can't find my parents, or parents saying, I need help because we don't have any place to stay? Do you ever get caught off guard like that?
Yes, we had a situation, I want to say maybe about 2 months ago, where we had a family that was here from Texas, and they had came here looking for work, and the father had thought that he had a job secured here. And after once getting here, found out that he wasn't going to be able to have that job, and they had no money, no place to go. and no way to get back home, and really didn't even have home in Texas because they got rid of everything to come here to Toledo. There were 8 children and 1 on the way. And when we met up with that family, our concerns were, if we pull these 8 children and put them into foster care, 1, we're going to have to split them all up. 2, it's a possibility that they wouldn't go back home with these parents. We were kind of afraid that the parents may run. So it was tough. It was tough. We were calling foster parents, and when you call foster parents, you know, they have to have the availability in their home to take more kids. Well, who has the availability for 8 children? And so we were going through the ages, with the oldest being 14 and the youngest being 1. And they kind of were stair steps all in between. And it was really sad because they were very close, very bonded with mom, very concerned about mom, and not wanting to leave her. And they were very, you know, close with one another and had been through a situation like this several times before. You know, and so one of the kids I kind of got close to just in the short amount of time as I was changing some diapers, she came and assisted me and was very, very mother-like. She was the mother at only 10 years old. And she was just talking to me, and she wanted to know, you know, if we go with you all tonight, will I ever see my family again?
At 10.
And I didn't want to lie to her. But it was so much I really didn't know at this time. And I was like, yeah, you're going to see your parents tomorrow. You know, that's what I was hoping and praying for. So we ended up splitting them up. They went to 4 different homes. And we met and sat with the parents, and we said, look, tonight you need to call. Find some family. Find someone, somewhere for you to go. Because we knew these kids came into care on a temporary basis, they probably weren't going to be going back home with that family. And so they were able to make contact with some family, and we put them on a Greyhound bus that next morning and sent them all to that family member. And that was probably one of the best feelings I've had in a long time, because I worried about those kids all night long. I haven't been out in the field in over 25 years. But it was just the idea. I really, really worried about what was going to happen to those kids if they came into care.
How long have you been doing this?
Well, I started when I was a very young little girl. Actually, I've been working for Children's Services for 34 years.
So that has to be hard on you. I mean, 34 years. Now, you're in a supervisory role at this point. However, you were still doing the same things that you would have done if you were out in the field. It's just, and that's, you said it tugged at you, because here's a 10-year-old talking to you as if they were an adult. And not only that, a 10-year-old from out of town.
Yeah, she was smart. She was definitely smart. And, you know, I just chalked it up to she had been here before, you know, based on some of her responses. But she was concerned about her siblings, herself, her parents, and she wanted me to tell her the truth.
Well, and it sounded like you kept it real, as they say, and keeping it real in this case worked out. But how do you keep yourself motivated? Because that's got to be, after 30-something years, that's got to be hard.
Well, it actually has gotten easier. What's hard is now trying to make the decision, do I continue? You know, is it time for me to retire? Or do I want to hang around a little bit longer? Now, that's the hard part. But for the most part, you know, when I think about Children's Services, we are a family. Sometimes we're dysfunctional. That is true. Like families. But I have met some wonderful people there over my career span that have become, you know, lifelong friends, as well as I always took when I worked with families, I wanted to give them something, but always wanted to take something from them too. And I think that's what kind of has given me longevity.
Does anyone ever come back and say thank you, or if they don't say thank you, because so for some people, that's not an inherent quality to say thank you or to even ask please or, you know, the everyday social graces. But they come back and say something to the effect of, had it not been for this organization, our family would not have made it. And as I'm saying that, Sherry, I'm thinking about families that they are dysfunctional because of whatever lifestyle, culture that they have. And yet, somebody will come back and say, as bad as our family, as messed up as our family is, it would have been worse if you guys hadn't did the little bit that you were able to do.
Yes. You know, not everybody comes back and thanks us, but we do have those who do. And at one point in my career, when I was an ongoing caseworker, I was one of the first drug court workers. And so drug court was something new. It was supposed to have been a pilot project, and it lasted for about 6 years as just a pilot, but was a very good program. And so I had some of my clients in drug court, and I used to have to remind them, you are here because you are the worst of the worst, you know, because they used to always, they got some special privileges, and we really worked real hard with them because it was kind of their last chance. And so I had several clients say, I didn't like you. You was hard on me, got on my nerves, talked about you a lot. But the thing of it is that if it wasn't for you pushing us and motivating us, we wouldn't have got it together.
I look at people who do this, and I'm looking from a distance because it's not my area of expertise. I just get concerned about people and how people treat other people. And when you find someone that goes on camera, they talk about what you mentioned earlier, they had a heart for this type of thing. Have you found that in this age where we're taking more selfies and they talk about the Me Too generation, do you still find that there's enough benevolence out there within the community that people open up their doors?
Yes. You know, I just think a lot of times we assume that people know what to do or how to help, but they really don't, and we have to educate them and be there to support them so that they know that there's a need. Because I know during COVID, we didn't have a lot of commercials and we weren't doing a lot of recruiting for foster and adoptive homes, but the need was there.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by the one commercial where the guy is packing up a garbage bag and it's his conditioning that whenever it's time to pack up that bag, it's time to move. And he's never going to stay any place very long until he gets to that one home. And they say, this is your room. And this is, all of this belongs to you. And all of a sudden, he's a little bit apprehensive.
Yes.
Because he may have heard that story before, but he finds out that he no longer has to be moved around. So that's got to make your people feel good and motivate them to keep pushing just a little bit more to make more scenarios like that come to fruition.
That is true. And you made me think of something when you mentioned the garbage bag. I know a lot of people kind of look down on us caseworkers or public children's service agencies because our kids transport their belongings in garbage bags. And I don't want anyone ever to think that we do that because we think that what they're transporting or what they have is garbage. It's convenient. It is so convenient. You can get more stuff in a garbage bag than you can a suitcase. So I had said, maybe when I retire, I'm going to make a special kind of bag. And we're not going to call it a garbage bag. We're going to call it a people bag. And that way, they would be different colors with different things on them, and kids could transport their stuff. Because I know a lot of times we get people that donate suitcases and all kinds of duffel bags to our agency. And we really do appreciate that, you know, and they'll say, well, we're doing this so kids don't have to have their stuff in the trash bag. And so I just want people to know it's not because we think it's trash. It's just so much easier. If you're moving a kid and they've got all these belongings and you've got six trash bags, let me tell you, you can fit them in the smallest of a car, you know. But if you've got six suitcases, we're going to have to leave something.
You know, and you mentioned that, but somehow my great niece got awarded to me. Now, this is not the other group. Oh. This is the niece of that group that okay. got separated. So this, I guess we've been through this in our family a few times. Okay. And I'm sitting there, and the person that she was residing with was another relative who had gotten mad at her,
okay.
highly offended. And she was throwing my niece's stuff out the door in those movable bags.
Okay.
And I understand, because if she had been throwing suitcases, it might have been an issue.
Yeah.
But she was unloading those bags, and I went and got the bags and put them in my vehicle, and we drove off into the sunset. So it's very convenient. I think you just came up with a fundraising.
Yeah, we got to have people bags.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had talked some time ago about, for lack of a better term, because I don't know what else you would call them, orphanages. They used to be popular, for lack of a better term.
Yes.
There were a lot of them around. As a matter of fact, that Hard Knock Life song where the orphans singing about their experiences within an orphanage.
Right.
It looks like that is starting to come back. I've seen a couple of scenarios. Was it Ryan Bromberg or Bromberg? He was here for the National Day of Prayer.
Yes.
And he was in a very unique situation. And I think he said he was only two of black kids, because I'm thinking, when he was talking about his family, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, you know, dad was, a doctor, and mom was a homemaker, and, you know, and then he put his family up on the screen. I said, well, wait a minute, that's not the...
No.
That is not what I had imagine in my mind.
And he lived in Amish country.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but his story was so unique. And he said he was not a perfect kid.
Right.
But everybody got along. Is that where we're going now? Do you get many scenarios where someone may have come out of that environment and they realize the need for that type of situation, and they start one themselves?
Well, you know, when we talk a little bit about Ryan Bomberger's story, his mom ended up kind of in an orphanage.
His real mother?
His adoptive mother.
Oh, okay. Really?
So how she started, when she was about 5 or 6, her parents were abusing substances. Her dad was drinking. And so she ended up in somewhat of an orphanage. And she noticed that a lot of the kids didn't have anyone to come visit them. Her parents were visiting because I guess maybe at that time they were working their case plan so that they could get their children back. And so she felt so bad for a lot of those other children. She had said a prayer. And in this prayer, she was saying that when she got out of there and she got grown and on her own, she wanted to help children who didn't have anyone to help them. No parents. She wanted to be a mommy for all the kids who didn't have parents. And so I think with that feeling, that's how she adopted and had 15 children.
That's serious. That is serious. Look, I was riding with you, but you said 15 children.
Yes, they ended up with 15 children. They had 3 biological children, and then they adopted 12.
All right, and then you also have another, again, it's not my area, but I'm going to use what I'm familiar with in terms of vernacular, another orphanage, Isaiah 1:17. that's something that's new? I mean, the concept is not new, but the way they do it.
Yes. I wouldn't categorize that as an orphanage. What Isaiah 117 wants to do is this. Right now in Lucas County, when we have kids come in, it's kind of the luck of the draw if we're able to find homes in our network for them. So many of the kids that we have in Lucas County are in private foster homes with other agencies, or they're in other counties. And there's been a couple of times where we've had kids that had to stay in our building because we couldn't find a home for them. So Isaiah 117, this house would be that refuge for those kids when they come in and we need a little more time finding placement for them, such as a scenario of multiples that come in. And so we got 5-6 kids and we've got to try to place them somewhere. This would buy us anywhere from 24 hours to 72 hours to look and see if we could find relatives, because we like placing with relatives. We like to look for them first, or our last resort is foster, but maybe we can get them in foster homes in the same area, or foster homes that know one another that they could still have contact. So it buys us some time.
Usually people going through that, they have a high anxiety level because they don't know what the next moment is going to hold. They're probably hungry.
Yes.
And there's a little bit of a shock. So I would imagine that something like an Isaiah 117 helps to calm them down, helps them to feel at ease, and gives them a little bit of hope.
Oh, definitely. So when they would come, you know, they would get a warm meal, they can take a bath, they have toys there, they have clothing there, anything that they need is there. You know, they'll have volunteers that will be working with the children. So it will be a nice place for them to help prepare them for, you know, what's coming next.
With what you do, I know it's ongoing training, right?
Yes.
So I don't have to be a clinician or someone who has a degree in social work to want to do what is required of a foster parent or to open up a foster home, because I'll get training through Lucas County Children's Services, right?
That is correct. We have 24 hours of training for our prospective foster and or adoptive parents. 3 of those hours are online and they can take them at their leisure, but we prefer that they take them before they take the other 21 courses.
Is it free?
It's free training, yes.
Now, I recall that I think at one time, in order to get a foster child, you used to have to be married. Is that still a requirement?
Well, that might have been before me, but for the most part, you don't have to be married. You can be single or partnered up. You don't have to own your own home. You can rent, live in an apartment, mobile home. You have to have your own income. So we do have some people who are retired or maybe on disability, and they still foster as long as their income takes care of their needs.
So I got to take care of me.
Yes.
You'll help me take care of my foster children.
Yes.
Seems like a good deal to me. I just got to have the right kind of heart. And I got to ask this. Is the screening better than what it used to be? I'm thinking about the gentleman who Cuba Gooding played in the Navy. He was in the Navy, and he was a diver, and he had a couple of bad foster homes that he went to. But that's the movies.
Well, yes, and sometimes, unfortunately, that can be real life too. You know, we do screen our foster parents. We do FBI finger checks. We do the BCI checks with them. We go out, we do home visits. We do as much vetting of them as we possibly can. The only thing is that people look real good on paper. And then a lot of times folks will say whatever they want to say. So we really don't know how well they're going to do with our children until we put them in the home. But we are there, you know, doing home visits, because each child that comes into care, that goes into foster care, has a foster care worker. They have an ongoing caseworker, and they also have a CASA or guardian appointed by the court. So we've got a lot of people checking in on those children.
And I would think that because of the size of our community, it's a little bit easier than if it's in a huge city like Chicago or Pittsburgh or something like that. Now, we're almost out of time. You got another story for me, just so that people can wrap their minds around that, you know, maybe that is something I really want to do, not because it's a perfect world, but because it's a perfect opportunity to make a difference in somebody's life.
You know, I want people, when you think about foster caring, you're helping the child, but you're also helping the child's family. You know, so you're fostering hope, you're fostering love, and you're fostering a family, because many of these kids we're hoping are going to be reunified with their family. And I know when I first started one of my first placements, I had this mother. She ended up in the emergency room, and she was developmentally delayed. Her stomach was hurting. She had no idea she was pregnant. And a couple hours later, she had delivered a baby. Had no clue what to do with this baby. And I felt so bad, because I knew for the most part, if I remove this baby, I'm going to have to remove this baby and place this baby more than likely is not going to go back to this mom. So when I ended up going through that process and then having to place this baby in a foster home, I was kind of concerned about the foster home when I went out there. And I had an African-American baby that was going to foster home with a Caucasian parent. And I was just like, oh, no, this is bad enough. He's male. He's possibly drug addicted. And then I'm going to put him in, you know, foster home, and well, there's nobody like him, you know. But I'm new. I'm very new. So I get out to the foster home. Foster mom invites me in. There's kids on both sides of the walls in the living room, pictures of children. So I'm just, you know, I'm holding tight onto this baby, and then I point to the left wall, and I'm like, who are all these kids over here? And she said, those were kids that I fostered. I was like, oh. And then I was like, well, who are all these kids over here? And she said, those are children that I have adopted. And she said, if you stick around for a few minutes, you'll get to meet the crew. So I waited around, and about seven kids had come in. They saw me, and they was like, oh, a new baby. She had African-American children, she had Caucasian children, and she had a few Hispanic children. They scooped that baby right out of my arms. I didn't even have a chance. Then she got to asking me, where's mom? What do you know about dad? I said, well, I don't know anything about dad, because mom doesn't even know how she got this baby. Well, to make a long story short, she ended up adopting this baby, but she also ended up adopting the mother too. So when I used to get pictures of him, you know, all his milestones, I'd look in the background amongst all the kids. Mom would be there too. When he graduated from high school, mom was right there. He went on to college, mom was right there. Now he's grown and on his own, and mom's still right there with that foster adoptive mom.
Sherry, that is powerful. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
There's an old Bible scripture that says, thou almost persuadest me.
Well, I'm going to keep working on you.
All right. And you're the one to get it done. I want to thank you, Sherry Dunn, for sharing with us and really helping people to understand that there is hope and that they can make a difference. They just got to be able to know where the resources are, how to reach out, and they call Lucas County Children's Services. They wouldn't necessarily call you, but they would call Lucas County Children's Services, right?
Well, they call our hotline, and so I have staff that answer the hotline, and then sometimes when they're not there, it's my turn. So they could give us a call at 419-213-213. 3-3-3-3-5.
Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate you. Well, I'm your host and producer, Jerome Graham. Our executive producer is Mr. Chris Piper. If you have any questions or comments, or you just want to listen again, go to wgte.org/hope, H-O-P-E, or wherever you stream your podcast. Thank you for listening to A Graham of Hope.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.